Thank you, President. I move we approve the minutes of the April 14th, 2021 Legislative Audit Subcommittee meeting.
We have a motion to approve the minutes of the April 14th, 2021 meeting. Do we have discussion on the motion? I'm seeing no discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Rule that motion passes unanimously. The first item up on the agenda for audit report is a follow-up audit for the safety and security within local homeless resource centers. I think Mr. Dean has that. So, Mr. Dean, if you're, let me get your mic on. And why don't you go ahead and introduce any presenters, okay?
Thank you, Mr. President. We're in the process right now of trying to get the presentation pulled up for you. But with me at the table is Jim B. Hunnan. He was the supervisor of this audit, along with, not here, but we also have Tyson and Gentry who worked on this audit with us. Back in 2018, our office released two audits regarding homelessness. The first one was on the health and safety of the facilities that were operated by the Road Home. And later that year, we released another audit that looked at the overarching system of financing and governance. This follow-up is a follow-up specifically to the health and safety issues in the homeless resource centers. We expect to release later this year another audit that addresses the overarching system of governance, accountability, performance metrics, and such within the homeless operations within the state. So, one of the things that we found as they're pulling this up, we want to publicly thank. We've worked with a number of people, with our new appointed state homeless coordinating commissioner. We've also had a very close working relationship with the homeless resource centers operators, the Volunteers of America, with the Road Home, and also with Shelter the Homeless, which is kind of, they're the ones that own all of the facilities. We worked very closely and very well with them throughout.
Thank you. Thank you. Looks like your presentation is coming up now. So, and again, we're excited to have everyone with us, and especially the new homeless coordinator, former President Niederhauser. So welcome to the meeting. Thank you. So why don't we go ahead with your presentation when you're ready.
We apologize for these technical difficulties.
No, we're fine. We'll just wait till you're ready there. And I had an item pop up on my screen and I tried to close it. I hope I didn't hurt your presentation. So we'll wait till we get we'll just wait for a minute until we get the PowerPoint up. This may be the quietest moment the speaker and I have for the last week. So kind of nice.
got a report. Everybody got a copy? We got me on mic yet?
Yes, we do have a copy. I think I have a copy in front of me, and
all right.
So why don't we move ahead? We have it. You know, there's always, when you live by technology, there's always a hard copy.
Well, yeah.
So let's go.
And this is the first time we presented in this room. I've presented in this room.
Okay, and they'll keep working on it. Why don't we go ahead and they may be able to catch you up electronically.
Let me remind you where we were at 3 years ago. Remember Operation Rio Grande, the conditions that we found down at the downtown homeless resource center. We issued a report back then, as Brian said, where we identified lack security, lack screening. As people came in, they could take practically anything they wanted inside the facility. We saw drugs and drug paraphernalia in the facility. There were evidence of drug weapons in the facility. We found the doors were not secure. In some cases, the security cameras were broken. And we described a fairly unsecure environment. This committee a few months ago asked us to go back and see if things have improved since we built the three new resource centers. We have shown here is the Geraldine E. King Women's Center. We have the Gail Miller Resource Center. It's for men and women. And we have a men's shelter in South Salt Lake. Wow. These are all three facilities that were built in the last couple of years and greatly improved the conditions there. And one of the benefits of starting over is that you can incorporate designs and functions into a new setting that are specific to some of your needs, such as security.
And they look like great facilities.
They are. And so our conclusion overall is that the safety and security have improved at the homeless resource centers. And in this chapter two, we give you some examples of why we think this is the case. One is they have a screening process as people enter the facility. As you can see here, this is at the Miller Resource Center. They're asked to pass through a magnetometer here. They put their bags or coats into a bin here, and the guards will look this over, and then, as you can see here, the guest is asked to, you know, reveal pockets or pull up their pant leg to show there's nothing hidden in their socks or their waistband. We know this is a fairly effective process because the guards report every incident when they find drugs on these folks, and there's a fair amount of that found. And so we feel like it's a fairly effective process. Another thing we've observed is just the physical facility. This is a picture of one of the dorms. They've been equipped with an observation room here with the windows where the staff can sit and observe the dorm area. One of the problems with the old downtown shelter was there were nooks and crannies all over the building where people could hide and get into trouble. They've also got security cameras, and we've seen these, and they work fairly effectively, and they're scattered throughout the building. And so we see these as great improvements. One of the challenges that we saw in the old downtown shelter was that some of the guests were reluctant to go to the shelter because the homeless have a lot of stuff. And if they couldn't find a place to put their stuff, then they were reluctant to go into the shelter. Well, one of the features that they have in the new resource centers is this storage room where guests can keep their belongings. Each guest is assigned two bins, and they're allowed to keep these in a secure area. Not only that, but they also get a bin under their bed. And so we think this has greatly reduced the theft of personal belongings.
They've also, one thing that we were quite impressed with is that the cities have created these special homeless outreach teams. This is the police departments that serve South Salt Lake and Midvale. Both of those communities receive special appropriations for funding to fund the homeless outreach units within the police departments there. The idea being that the officers can provide a consistent and frequent law enforcement presence at the resource centers. And we're told that the officers who are selected for these units are picked because they've demonstrated the ability to engage the homeless in a positive manner. The officer can develop a relationship with the homeless, encourage them to get off the street and into the resource centers, and the officers can respond to incidents of drug use and other criminal activity that may occur in the resource centers. And so we see these as a great improvement over to what we saw down in the downtown shelter before. Chapter 3. Now, having said that, in Chapter 3, we suggest there are some opportunities to continue to for further improvement, to further reduce drug use and other criminal activity in these resource centers. And although we believe things have greatly improved, we still found some problems with drug use, theft, assault, and other kinds of criminal activity in the resource centers. And I think at this point, it's important to recognize that the homeless, that many of the residents in our homeless resource centers suffer from drug addiction, mental illness, and some of them have extensive criminal records. And that's why it's unlikely that the resource centers will ever be entirely free of guests who do their best to get drugs into the facility, who for whatever reason are engaging in other criminal activity within the resource center. We found evidence of this ongoing activity in the incident reports prepared by the staff. We saw this on our review of the security camera recordings. We interviewed guests of the facility. Half of them, about half that we spoke with, said that they'd seen evidence of drug use. One gentleman said he had used drugs in the facility himself. And in addition, we've observed evidence of drug use ourselves. For example, late one night, we went to the men's resource center with two officers from the Department of Public Safety. The officer said as they approached the building, they could smell the spice, the scent of spice, that the drug spice. And when we entered the facility and went into this courtyard area that's shown here, we observed someone pass out, apparently from the effects of spice. We also observed a resident as we entered the courtyard, and he saw that we had officers with us. He suddenly became nervous and quickly disposed of something in the garbage, and we found this pipe in the garbage shown here. And mind you, this is a secure area after they've passed through the screening process and somehow been able to avoid detection of some of this material. And so we've concluded that there is still a problem with drug use in the facilities, but it will be an ongoing challenge for the resource centers, given the population that they serve. And so what we've done in Chapter 3, at the end of Chapter 3, we've offered some suggestions, some ways that they can respond to this ongoing challenge. In some ways, we're simply asking them to do some things that they've already done, but do it a little bit better. One of those is the screening process. We found that they could be a little bit more diligent, the security guards, as they examine the guests as they come through that security station, the screening station. We observed instances in which the personal items were not really searched very well. And in fact, a couple of cases, we saw guests passing through without being screened at all. In the past, the resource center operators have invited drug sniffing dogs into the facilities, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there has been some reluctance for them to be in the facilities. And so we've recommended, as soon as things open up a bit, and we don't think that's too far away, that we'll see the canine units return to the facilities. We're also asking that they look at their staffing levels. The requirements currently in their policies is in the green here. And let me just, it's basically that they, for every 90 guests that they have, one security guard. This standard was developed before they were up and running and really had a good idea about the workload that these guards would be asked to do. And so we're recommending that they reevaluate the staffing levels to see if it's meeting the needs. And finally, we're asking that the owner and the operators of the resource centers develop a more consistent policy regarding how staff should respond when they find guests that have been found using drugs or have drug paraphernalia or somehow violating the code of conduct of the facility. For example, they have a policy that if a guest is found using drugs in the facility, the first violation would be a 30-day eviction. But we found that this penalty is hardly ever imposed on the guests. And so we're encouraging the Shelter of the Homeless to work with their resource center operators and their local community partners to come up with a policy that is consistently applied. And finally, to our last chapter, Chapter 4, resource centers require support from public and nonprofit partners. What we're trying to explain in this chapter is that the resource centers are being asked to serve an extremely challenging population, and that the resource centers can't be expected to manage this population on their own. What they need is some support from their partners in the community. And what we're saying is that we have this study here. We provide data that describes the results of a study we did of the guests at the men's shelter. This is on page 30. We took a sample of guests and looked at how many had been in prison, how many had been in jail, we looked at their court records, we looked at how many had been to a drug treatment or mental health treatment program, and we found that 61% of the guests had received treatment for mental health, drug use, or had been arrested for drug use. And we found 32% had a felony conviction on their record. And what this means is you've got a population, well, for example, the felony convictions. It's hard to get a job, hard to find housing. This is a serious barrier to ending homelessness, is that felony conviction. The mental health and the 61% with the, what did I say, 61% with the drug use or mental illness, another barrier to overcoming homelessness. What we're saying is, for a large portion of this population, will require years of both housing and treatment. This is a difficult population to serve. And although for some of them, what they're going to need is permanent supportive housing or some other residential treatment option. And while these treatment options are growing every year, we're adding capacity every year. It's not keeping up with the demand. And although we may have Section 8 vouchers for housing, this population will need much more than that. And so what we're saying is it could take years before we have an adequate capacity to meet the needs of this population, who right now all we have is the homeless resource centers for. So in the meantime, while we're adding capacity to meet these needs, the resource center operators will need help from the from service providers and their community partners to better manage this high-risk population while they continue to live in the resource center. And so we've identified several things that need to happen to address that need. One of those is that we go and make sure that we have a consistent and frequent presence by law enforcement at the resource centers. And this gets back to what we said just a minute ago, describing the homeless outreach units that the police departments have in Salt Lake, in South Salt Lake and Midvale. And what we're saying is that this presence needs to be ongoing and maybe even increase. In addition, we need to improve the communication between the resource centers and law enforcement. Law enforcement should receive a monthly report from each resource center identifying the criminal offenses that have occurred in the resource center. And they should also, the resource center should also be providing law enforcement with the incident reports that identify the guests by name who have been found using drugs or committing other illegal acts. We also found that the resource centers could do a better job of sharing information at their periodic coordination meetings with the law enforcement and the security guards. These are meetings where they have the resource center staff together with the law enforcement officer assigned to the facility and the security guards, and they discuss common security problems. While we think these meetings are great, they don't always talk about what we refer to as the high utilizers, who are residents of the facilities. These are residents that need attention of law enforcement and the security guards and the staff on an ongoing basis. We believe by discussing the needs of this population and specific individuals, in fact, that the staff and the guards and the law enforcement will be able to provide a better response to their activity. Anyway, in sum, we believe these things have improved from 3 years ago. There's no doubt about that. But we do need to recognize that we're asking the resource centers to deal with a very difficult population. They're always going to be a challenge. There's always going to be a struggle to deal with their drug use, and some have severe mental illness. And there will always be things that they can improve on. We hope that this report provides some direction as to how they can make the next step forward. Mr. President,
thank you for that presentation. And maybe before we take questions, do you want to take questions first or hear from the responses? Representative King, I see your light on.
I do have a question, I think, for Jim.
Go ahead, your mic's on.
Thank you. It strikes me that your comment, Jim, that this is a difficult population is undeniably true. My question is, as part of the audit, did you make any attempt to evaluate the extent to which the resources that are provided to our HRCs are sufficient to address the need for these kind of problems that you've identified, the drug use and other kind of problems that the audit highlights?
We did not. We have a state strategic plan that was put together by the State Homeless Coordinating Committee. And they, in that plan, have identified that very thing as a gap. And so we're taking that at face value, that we have, as a community, already identified that as a need. We are going to be preparing a second report that talks about global issues, strategic planning. Are we getting the best bang for our buck? Are we monitoring results? And this will be an issue that we delve into a little more in that report. I don't know that we're in the position to, or ever will be, to say, okay, we need X, Y, and Z. But let me just give you my back of the envelope calculation. Our best guess is, and the provider community has agreed when I've suggested this, there's about 1,200 individuals who are chronically homeless or who are facing mental illness. who are among our homeless population. 1,200 individuals, that's a lot to provide some kind of permanent supportive housing program to. We think, and we will get into this, like I said, into the next report, how exactly we address that need. But that is our ongoing challenge. If you can give us a few months, we'll have a good answer for that question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that question. Not seeing any other questions, so thank you, Mr. Dean and Mr. Buchanan. So why don't we go ahead and have the response? We've got, again, former Senate President Niederhauser here. I'm not sure you're really on the job yet. And then we've got Ms. Hopkins, who's the Executive Director of the Shelter of the Homeless. Good to have both of you here. And I'm not sure which one of you is going to respond, but your mics are on and you can decide, okay? Yes, it is. I'm not going to turn President, well, I will turn his mic on. I was not going to turn Speaker Wilson's mic on, but there it is.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's great to be here in this new committee room. So this is outstanding. Is this the new Star Wars room?
No, it's, well, I'm not sure what it is, but it has a lot better cameras than our other committee room. So it's been a phenomenal effort during the session. We were able to take public comment from around the state, so it's really kind of nice.
It's amazing. So excited to be here today to talk about homeless services.
Are you officially on the job yet?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Okay. When the law went into effect, what was it, May 3rd or 5th? We were officially the Office of Homeless Services for the state. It's a statewide, we have a statewide mandate to address homelessness from St. George to Logan to Monticello. We have local coordinating councils all over the state. There are 13 of them. A couple of them are called something different than, I'm just learning some of the terms. And I just also want to introduce Tricia Davis, who's here today. She's the assistant director for our office and here to support our response to this audit, because this is something, we're just a new office, and but we know, or at least I know, that the auditors are a huge benefit to the state and help direct us and help us improve in our processes. And so we applaud the audit, and we want to, and our responsibility in this audit as an office is we do contracts and to the providers. And so, you know, this type of information is very helpful to us as we're coming up on a new contract year, probably a little bit late for that, but as we go forward and in years to come, we'll be able to include these kind of recommendations because we control budgets for the Resource Center, at least with state funds. And but I was in your chair when we got the first audit, and it was a scathing audit of the resource centers. And so we're just very happy that there's been tremendous improvement made. And I just want to highlight one thing that seems obvious to me at this point, and then we'll turn it over to the providers to respond, that if we don't have a good exit strategy for people out of the resource centers, into more permanent or midterm type of housing or treatment, then our bottleneck is going to be the resource centers. And we won't be able to build enough resource centers to handle all the need out there. And so what seems to be, at least for me at this point, one of the objectives that we should have is getting people in the resource that come into the resource center out of the resource center as quickly as possible into some kind of a more permanent situation, thus because of that throughput or that pipeline. I believe if that's happening in a healthy fashion, and I guess the auditors will address this in the next audit, then, you know, I think we have quite a bit of capacity. It all depends on how quickly we can get them to resources outside of the resource center. And then there's the question, and this comes up regarding safety and the security of the resource centers. Is it a low barrier resource center, or is it a high barrier? What, how you get into the resource center? Because if it's a really high barrier, then people are just going to choose to live on the streets rather than go into the shelter. So those are a lot of questions and issues that I can see that I hope to get my head wrapped around. The people that are already in this, the providers and Tricia and our other staff, they know it well. I'm just the new guy on the block trying to get my a better understanding of it. So we'd be happy to take any questions, and that's why I brought Tricia with me today.
Thank you, and appreciate your service. And any other comments before we open it from any Laurie or Tricia, anyone, before we open it up for? And then I see online we've got.
I do have some comments.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm Laurie Hopkins, Executive Director of Shelter the Homeless. I'm also the Vice Chair of the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness. Thanks so much for the opportunity to present today. And also thanks to the audit team. We really appreciated your thoroughness and also your professionalism throughout the audit. I'm pleased to address the recommendations in the audit. The Shelter the Homeless has had a more central involvement in this particular audit compared to the prior audits, because we now both own the three HRCs, as well as provide some overarching structure and services in the HRCs, including contracting with a security firm to ensure trained security officers are in the HRCs 24/7, 365 days a year. The primary goal of the HRC model, which launched in mid-2019, just a short time ago, is to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring by providing emergency shelter coupled with case management to help those experiencing homelessness resolve their immediate crisis and rapidly return to stable housing or other services. And individuals accessing the system actually come through a coordinated entry system, and HRCs are on the front line with resources to provide basic needs to these individuals and to connect them with appropriate services. The HRCs are fulfilling that objective on behalf of the community and have served about 5,000 individuals to date since opening. I'd like to highlight the high level of collaboration and partnerships in the HRC model, which has led to consistent and cohesive systems with service providers striving to improve their work together. Since we're approaching almost 2 years with this HRC model, it's actually a good time to review the HRC policies and procedures and ensure that they are both best practices and fulfilling the needs of clients. So in terms of Shelter the Homeless and the HRC operators, we welcome the auditor's recommendations. We're working to address each one, and we're ready to refine our approach to best serve this community. In terms of the first set of recommendations, the opportunities that exist for resource centers to further reduce criminal activity, canine units in the HRCs, staffing levels to meet the needs, and violation protocols reviews, we're actively assessing and working toward solution in these areas. In terms of the second set of recommendations, that resource centers require support from public and nonprofit partners, HRCs are part of a broader system to serve our community, and we look forward to partnering with the community for increased options to address affordable housing, mental health, and addiction issues, among others. The recommendations in this section center around working with local law enforcement. Specifically, the approach is working with the homeless community, sharing information and reporting. As evidenced in the report, we have regular meetings and strong ties with local law enforcement, and we look forward to continuing and deepening our engagement with them. The audit demonstrates the HRC system is serving individuals experiencing homelessness with a healthy, safe, and secure environment overall. And progress has been strong over the last 3 years, and we will continue to work to improve the model and the services provided as time goes on. Developing and launching the HRC system is a long journey that has required considerable community efforts, and the intent is to continue to refine and evolve the approach. We also welcome the new governments and funding structure based on HB 347 and are actively working with Mr. Niederhauser and his team already. I would hope that you would refer to our written response for the specifics on how we will address each individual recommendation rather than going through them here. But before I close, I'd like to note that new HRC centers operated only for a few months before the pandemic hit. Permanent capacity in the HRCs was adjusted or slightly reduced due to COVID-19 social distancing needs, although we continue to serve at over 90% capacity most of the time. The HRCs have been a safe environment for clients throughout the pandemic, with infection rates mostly below the community overall, and also the vaccination rates have outpaced the overall community. So it's a testament to the incredible collaboration within the system. I appreciate the opportunity to respond to the audit and share this work with the subcommittee and auditors. And the HRCs will continue to serve this vulnerable population with respect and dignity. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that response. We have a question from Representative Gibson, who's online with us.
Thank you, Mr. President. I don't know that I have a comment on the audit other than to say that we knew that there were going to be issues that they found. I want to commend all the hard work. There are many people that work with this population. It is a difficult population. And I think we started down this journey a few years back with the previous speaker and others and the president when he was the president of the Senate to start trying to address this. And I think were there mistakes made? Yes. Were there lots of good things done? Yes, there were. I think many people probably could have taken this job, Senator Niederhauser, and people that may know the acronyms or the verbiage or some of the things that the terminology that's needed and history of these folks. But I will say this, I don't know those folks, but I know you. And I am grateful that you're there. I'm grateful that you will look at this as a means to get people out and to become more independent and hopefully living in a better situation than when they came into the shelters, results driven. I look forward to continue to work. I have full confidence in you and to the people. I'm looking at you there to my right, but I guess they would be sitting to your left, those content experts that will help guide you. And anyway, I don't want your head to get too big. I know it's a hard job. But just know that I do appreciate you, and I look forward to the continued work in trying to make some success and a difference in some of these people's lives. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Echo that. Senator Main, and then I'm going to go to Speaker Wilson.
Thank you very much. I echo, I've always been a Niederhauser fan, so that's pretty good from a Democrat. But I look at and through the years that we've been through it, funding, not funding, changing programs or whatever. How homelessness, it, to me, is like circles, circles, circles. And the out circles are those that have just run out of money and, you know, whatever. And then we have those that have health issues. And then it goes down and down and down and down. And we can handle those. You know, here comes the families. Your turnover rates so many days, right, when you get families. So I think we've been able to handle those pretty well. She needs daycare, we give her daycare. So we can do that. Problem is those hundreds some odd people, whatever that number is, 1,200, or we spoke this morning about that, and whatever they that is. And I think we're going to get everybody off the homelessness or not. There's a group, and as a society, we take care of that group, and we might, addiction or mental health, whatever that is, and they continually go back, and so we have issues with that group. And I think that's where we need to do, are we as a society going to take those that cannot go back to society, they cannot function? So we need to have a community to them, and I don't know what that looks like, and let them flourish in that community and give them the responsibilities they can in that community. Because we whatever we try to do, they can't work there. So we have to find something that works for them. And I, whether it's a village, a home, a community that they're able to function in, so they're not on the street. And but I think we need to go that way, because there's been homelessness before dinosaurs, whatever. That's an exaggeration, but I'm saying the problem is there. And I think we need to realistically who we can work with, where they're, and the circle gets little, all these little circles get littler until we have this population. And I think that's where we need to put some thinking power is, and it, do we have, did they live communally in an area that we can control that? And maybe they can do and grow within that structure. I don't know, because they keep going like this. They just go in and out and in and out. So that's, I think it behooves us to figure out what fits them best, not what we think they should be. So thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator Maine. I'll go to Representative King, then the speaker. How about that? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to specifically direct your attention, Ms. Hopkins, to pages 25 and 26 of the audit. This talks about the problem that, or the fact rather, that the auditors identified of having a disparity between the policies in place at the HRCs for the consequence of the first violation regarding drug use of a 30-day eviction and the actual practices at the HRCs of not, of rarely imposing that. And I just wanted to say, I think that's important for this reason. I don't know what the proper consequence should be or is in terms of best practices and what experts in the field would suggest is the way to approach that. And that's something that I would defer to you and others about how to handle. But I do think that I agree with the auditors that this is not something that's a small thing. I think that when you have the kind of disparity that has been identified here, what you do is encourage a general disrespect and disregard for rules in the facility. And if people know, yeah, there's what's on the books and then there's what actually happens and there's a big gap between the two, that's not a productive or healthy environment. So again, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the best policy is, but I would encourage you to pay particular attention to that. I saw your response indicating that you were gonna work on that and have some something to concrete to address that by September, which I appreciate, thank you. I just want to make sure that from my perspective, that is an important discrepancy, disparity to address. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. President. You know, when I got up this morning, I had no idea we'd be talking about dinosaurs at the Capitol. So, Senator Maine, thank you. It's good to hear your perspective. Wayne, it's good to see you here, even though you're a long way away. So I know you've been traveling the state trying to assess not just the issues in Salt Lake County, but across the state. And I'm just wondering if you could shed some light on that. Someone that doesn't live in Salt Lake City or county, sometimes we feel like some of the issues outside of Salt Lake County get forgotten. And I'm just curious what your perspective is on that. And then also sort of maybe you could just share with us your timeline to kind of reassess the next level of thinking and implementation that needs to occur.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for that this opportunity. So I'm yet to go to St. George and Cedar City. That's next week. I've been up north, and what I've seen so far, there's similar elements to the situation between Salt Lake City and Ogden, because that's what I've been able to see so far. I think I'm going to find a lot of the same things in St. George. The area is different. the local policies are different, and that's going to be a good education for me and for the state and for our office to find out what's working there. There are, you know, some geographical differences, but I think for the most part, we're dealing with people that, you know, are suffering from addiction, from mental illness, who have been abused, you know, maybe even from childhood. And so the problems are deep seated. And Senator Maine, I think, rightfully, expresses that this is a big challenge. It could be the biggest challenge that we have as a state, because we do, as a society, we don't want people to be suffering. And I believe, because I've been spending some time on the streets a little bit, and I believe that there's hope. Senator Maine, I think there's hope for every person out there. We just need to find what that is. And that's going to take quite a bit of effort to discover what works for, somebody with addiction. And that's a spectrum of issues. we all have poverty in us. That's one thing that has come to my mind. But we have made maybe some, we've made some healthy lifestyle choices. Or we haven't had a knee operation and been on opioids and ended up like a friend of mine, homeless, who had a thriving business. But he got addicted to opioids and then heroin and all kinds of other things and lost everything. And if it wasn't for his support group, his family, then he'd be out on the street. And but I know that his family aren't really happy with him, and are on the verge of kicking him out all the time also, because he seems to be in this spin cycle. So this is the challenge, but I believe there's hope. I really do. And it's addressing individual needs, and that starts at the resource center. Being able to effectively assess what this person can benefit from, and then providing that. And we have a strategic plan, but our office has been mandated by statute to review that plan. And I know the philanthropic community, who I'm very close to, want that reviewed. And we have a new council with some new members on it and some that are not going to be there anymore. But our timeline is that hopefully by the fall we've reviewed that strategic plan and hopefully have modified it so that it will then, I'd like to come to an interim committee before interim is over, so that this new strategic plan then can inform us, the legislature, and all of us in our communities on the direction, a unified direction that we should go, given that there are some flexibilities because of the area in which you live, or if you're in Monticello versus Logan versus Salt Lake City. I hope that answers your question. Be happy to address it further if I didn't address it.
Appreciate all three of you and your service, and we'll look forward to hearing those reports. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any other questions. And I'd like to thank our auditors. You always do a good job. Very, very, the previous audit to this one, former Senate President Niederhauser's right on. There's night and day. So thank you for that audit. And thank you for the responses to the audit and the great efforts you've made. And, this is probably, I think you're right, this is probably the biggest problem we face as a state. And when we look at substance abuse and the things that it causes and the challenges in people's lives. And but I don't know anyone, and I know Wayne Niederhauser fairly well. I don't know anyone in the state that is more capable of handling this than you are. And I want to thank you for your commitment and for your decision to serve in this regard, and really appreciate what you're what you've decided to do. So thank you very much.
Thanks thank for the pressure.
Pressure, but you I've always seen you step up. So thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go on to the next audit if we can. We need a motion, don't we? Yes. I'll take a motion from Speaker Wilson.
I move we refer a follow-up audit of the safety and security within local homeless resource centers to the Economic Development and Workforce Services Interim Committee as the lead committee, and the Health and Human Services Interim Committee as the review committee.
Thank you. We have a motion. See no discussion. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Rule that motion passes unanimously. Now let's move on to the next item, which is a six-month follow-up review of the 9/11 call center. Again, I'll go to Mr. Dean, and you can introduce. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. This audit was requested by the subcommittee last year when we completed our work regarding following up on previous 911 audits, and then also looking at call answering times and queue times as within the state's 911 system. Specifically, we were asked to look at the call answering times because of concerns presented in that report regarding VEC, and also to look at and review Salt Lake 911. So with me at the table is Jake Dinsdale. He's one of our senior audit supervisors. And Mr. President, with your permission, I'll turn the time over to him and he'll present the findings.
Thank you. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. As Brian mentioned, we're following up. This is a six-month follow-up. Just a brief review of the standard. The national standards from the National Emergency Number Association say that for all 911 calls, 95% of those should be answered within 20 seconds. So that's the standard that we've used as our benchmark for these key figures we're going to show you. Also, just a reminder, these standards are reflected in statute now. They were passed as condition for certain funding from UCA. This is the line we presented last August. This shows monthly call answering at Salt Lake Valley Emergency Communications Center, also known as VEC, over the entire breadth of data we can get our hands on. So as you can see, the performance has largely lived below the standard of 95% within 20 seconds. We have updated this analysis. This one that you can see ran through April of 2020. We have brought it through March of 2021, and you can see a wide range of performance since we last spoke in August. Down in September of 2020 at 63.2%, up to just over 90% in January of 2021. You may have noticed in the response letter from the agency, they note operational changes they have sought to make, budget increases, a significant amount of hiring. So far, however, the call performance has not quite made it over that line. As part of the motion from the subcommittee, Salt Lake City 911, you wanted us to update those numbers. You can see historically from about 2013 to 2017, they were kind of flirting with the line of 95%. But as of 2018, the end of 2017 really, they have been above the 95% threshold. And in our updated numbers, again reflected in the orange, they have stayed above that line. And we have also confirmed that every other PSAP in the state has maintained their performance above the 95% threshold, again, except for the VEC numbers we just showed you. The final portion of this, in response to your request to know about call answering performance, we updated our analysis of the automated call queue. This is where callers are placed on hold if there aren't enough call takers to handle that traffic. We broke it into percentages this time because the call volumes were different from year to year, but in 2019, you see that a total of 40.7% of emergency callers went on to this call queue. 2020, that increased 6.5% to 47.2. So a larger proportion of callers waited in 2020 when compared to 2019. And finally, we ran some benchmark analysis against some other large PSAPs. Salt Lake City 911 and Weber happened to share the same phone system that VEC uses, and we ran the queue numbers for them as well. You can see here that Salt Lake City and Weber in yellow and orange are down kind of similar to one another, and VEC in green is significantly higher in the way that they use the automated call queue. So there's our full presentation on this brief little update in response to your motion.
Wow, thank you for that report. Do we have questions? You know, one thing I noticed on both the Salt Lake and the VEC system is before 2012, before the beginning of time, I guess, back, both of them were above that 95% line, and they dropped down, and the Salt Lake City came back up, but VEC didn't. So anyway, so it's possible, I guess is what I'm saying, back before 2012. We have a response. Seeing no questions, I'll open it up for the response from the agency. I think we have the Executive Director of Salt Lake Valley Emergency Communications back. Go ahead. Scott Ruff, right?
Yes, Mr. President. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, committee, appreciate your time and this opportunity to respond to the audit. And I want to take the opportunity to thank Mr. Tinsdale, Mr. Dean for their work and their coming out and visiting VEC and reviewing our numbers and our operation. As was stated last time I was before this committee, we have made some changes to the operation and continue to make changes. In September of 2020, after the initial audit was released, the Board of Trustees adopted interim performance standards, which could be achieved within the existing budget. In December of 2020, they tied my pay incentives and my performance to the performance of VEC to include call center answering performances. And then this March of 21, as part of the budget process, we took a deep dive into the fiscal 22 budget and what it would take to achieve not only short-term success, but continued success moving forward in the operations of VEC, resulting in fee increases and budget increases to law enforcement agencies of over 15%. And for fire EMS at 11.5%. Since September of 2020, we've committed to staffing. We've hired more than 24 911 call takers. Our attrition rate has gone from, and I should back up, I've been here since the end of January of 2020, so I'm about 15 months in, hired specific to address these performance issues. Our attrition rate has gone from approximately 47 to 48% to about 10%. We're changing the culture at VEC and the conditions of the working environment. We continue to work with UCA and our partner agencies in Salt Lake City and Weber and the other PSAPs on the Wasatch Front here and in the Valley in a common CAD project with the support of UCA and funding from UCA. And that'll be achieved at the end of this year. So we'll be all on a single common CAD platform. We'll be taking and processing each other's 911 calls, eliminating the need for transfers and making things more efficient for the system. We're anticipating a new next-gen 911 phone system from UCA, which I am a firm believer will greatly enhance our capabilities as we continue to leverage our technology, the change in culture, and the performance of VEC overall. I really would like to just entertain any questions or comments, but the trustees, myself, are committed to the success of VEC and increasing the performance for what the constituents, our member agencies, and the service that are expected of a 911 center, the size of VEC in a state such as Utah, and we continue to work towards that. I do issue every month a progress and performance report, good, bad, or indifferent. I believe Speaker Wilson receives a copy of that, Representative Handy, Senator Harper, and I believe it's Representative Hall. I've recently included Mr. Tinsdale in that as well, so we can make sure we're monitoring and tracking the same information. So,
thank you. I think the Ms. Speaker Wilson has a question.
Thanks. So, Mr. Ruff, thank you for coming. It sounds like you've been busy. Lots going on, I appreciate the audit update from Jake and Brian, but when we, was it last fall we met? Is that when this audit came out? It seems like just yesterday. I think when we set this 6-month kind of check in. We were sort of hoping that things would be a little different than they are in terms of getting to that 95% threshold. Do you want to just speak to that in terms of sort of that being the point of arrival and when that is going to happen in your estimation, or what is preventing that from happening now?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I think there's a combination of things. As I stated, we continue to hire personnel, and the training is anywhere from 2 to 5 months, so it takes people that long to get trained and released on the floor to be able to receive and process 911 calls. We're still managing 2 CAD systems inside the center, so depending on where the 911 call comes from, it has to be determined if it goes into one CAD system, or for certain cities, it goes into another CAD system. If it's a police and fire, it might go into both CAD systems. So there's managing that technology. And then there's also the managing of a legacy 911 phone system, which we hope to have the new 911 phone system live in July, which will help mitigate, I believe, many of these challenges and show improvement and give us a better understanding and picture of truly where our performance is. I mean, it's not anywhere where it needs to be, but we continue to make progress month over month. I mean, when you look, we started in the high 60s and the 70 percentiles, and we've broken 80, the mid 80s. January was just over 90%. So I feel we're on the right track. The board is supportive of making those changes. I get cautious to say we can do it in 3 months or 6 months. All I can do is promise that the board has invested in me, we've invested in the center and our people and the resources. We believe we can achieve that success with the technology implementations being implemented over the next couple of months. So I think you'll continue to see improvements to the point where we're going to meet those standards.
So that's helpful. I guess part of the reason why I don't want to get too much into this right now, Scott, but part of the reason why we wanted to have this check-in is I've had some questions about whether or not this is the right model. And if we can't get this objective achieved, it just seems like at some point maybe we need to try a different approach. And so I actually, if I were in your shoes, I don't know how excited I would be about saying we're going to get to 95% by October 1st, come hell or high water. But that's kind of what I think we're looking for. It's like, when is the organization, when are we going to get to a place where we've got a consistent delivery of service that meets the minimum threshold of expectation? And policymakers are going to say, maybe we need to try a different approach. And so I'm not trying to be confrontational. I'm just, our job is to make sure we deliver the right policy and the right structure to get the services to citizens that we need. And it just seems like we can't get line of sight to when that's going to happen or what that's going to look like. And so, maybe Jake, you have some thoughts in terms of what, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I guess I just did. Sorry, too late. But, what is this going to look like in another, if we have you come back in another 6 months, is it going to be the same thing? Or do we think we're going to start to see some consistent improvement?
Go ahead, Jake, if you want.
That's, as Scott has suggested, a very, very big question with a lot of possible answers. I'm not even sure where to begin in terms of what, there's so many moving pieces right now with the budget and where we can see the board. We reviewed some board minutes, since our last meeting in August when this was initially presented, and some big, big things. That CAD system has been a long time coming to unify UPD, which used to be physically outside the building, and now they're inside the building. Huge sea change, but they're still not, the technology hasn't fully merged, as Scott just spoke about a moment ago. So there's some big operational stuff to do, some new technology coming online. Yeah. There's so many factors coming that I'm just...
I get it. And Scott, maybe you can just manage my expectations and then exceed the delivery of those. So is it a year out? Or are we 2 years out? When is this going to get to the place we need it to get to?
Like I said, I'm not trying to politic you. It's a work in progress. This is an organization, when I got here, whose performance and culture was fairly low. I've done this around the country. This is my seventh state for over 30 years. we can deliver what you expect and what the citizens expect and what my member agencies expect. When you have a culture of an organization that was at its low of its low, and I mean attrition rates in dispatch are 25 to 30% as it is, at almost 48% a year and a half ago, to about 10%. We're not losing people because it's they're unhappy. It's getting the right people. It's getting them trained, and we don't want to rush it and say, okay, you're hired today, and in 30 days, we're going to bless you and hope you handle that 911 call right. There's certain liabilities there, and so. Again, in 6 months, a month over month, I'm confident you're going to see continued improvement. In 6 months from now, I hope that number is in that 90 to 95%. I truly do, and I think we can get there. We are in this industry, not just in VEC, but statewide and around the country in 911. At least for Utah, we're fighting for the same pool of people. We're no different than any private sector corporation, and this, the pandemic didn't help, some benefits didn't help, and people think now they're worth $25 and $30 an hour, and we don't have a problem with doing that, but we need you to learn the job and show us you're going to come to work and perform, and we'll be more than happy to reward that. We've talked about that with my finance person. We've talked about it at the budget of redoing our compensation packages, but money doesn't solve everything. And I might have said this last time I was here. One of the things I get concerned about with the board is I don't want to tell my board of trustees that I need 25 more people and $3 million and then still fail. It's not fair. It's not the right way to manage. It's not the especially a vital or core public safety agency like that. So again, I apologize. I'm not trying to avoid the question. I'm just trying to avoid the getting pigeonholed into that by October 1st, but I will promise and can commit to continued improvement till we meet that standard, because I don't want to just hit that standard in 2 or 3 months and say we did it, and then someone does a look back in 6 months or a year and they say, well, yeah, you hit it 1 month, what happened, right? We need to be able to make it sustainable. Yep. and build that foundation for the future. So, again, with those moving parts, and the technology and the people is our most important asset. We got a great group of people out there. A lot of people that didn't want to be there are now gone, so we're picking who we want to bring in now and hopefully have the right folks, and we're committed to that change and that changing culture and the continued delivery of services. Maybe not today at the level you all expect or would like to see, but we are making month over month improvement.
Okay, well, we'll just go on this journey with you and check back in maybe another 6 months.
Yep, I'm available whenever you deem it necessary. In 2-3 years, that'd be great.
Okay, Jake, you probably had another comment.
Yeah, now that I've had 30 seconds to ponder on the big question, just to your point about the model and the questioning of the model and the size, I think Scott spoke to some of his out-of-state experience. We have Weber County, Salt Lake City, we have Central Utah 911, all three quite large. They're nowhere, not in the ballpark of VEC. VEC is very, very large. But in terms of large PSAPs that function well, we have a model within the state. And even in the medium-sized PSAPs, some very well-managed. We mentioned the culture in the August report. I think to a degree we agree with that assessment that there was a cultural issue. And those changes can be difficult.
Well, and I think it's realistic that there is probably going to be a lag between pulling levers that are going to make a meaningful difference and seeing those levers that you pulled show up in the data and the results. And I'm just asking for how long pulling those levers leads to the results showing up. And so we'll just check back.
Okay, Jake, that was going to be my comment too, and we got Senator Vickers that's got a question, but my comment or question, I maybe I'll just leave it at that, is that we're going to hear from Salt Lake City here in a minute. And we're going to hear that they've actually been able to increase and resolve the problem or reduce their call times, and the other agencies are doing it. So there are models, and there are, I assume those models are being funded with similar tax dollars that are and similar budgets and similar. So I think there are models, and I'm extremely encouraged with the retention or the turnover from 40 to 10. That's extremely positive. I think you're headed in the right direction. We just hope that you're able to take some of the other things going and some of these agencies apply them and improve. So, Senator Vickers, I'm going to go to you.
Yeah, thanks. Just a couple of questions. The one thing as I was looking at the graphs, the one thing that kind of stood out to me is the, and this goes back, you know, for 10 years, and that precedes you as well, but just the really inconsistency that it's got a wide range. Is there any kind of a, and then in the last 6 months, you know, it's even got worse. Is there a specific reason for that inconsistency? I know that's big and all that, but is there a specific reason for that wide range? Because I look at, you know, the only thing I've got compared to really is the other graph, and it's a lot tighter, you know, they have some ups and downs, but it's a lot tighter.
Sure. So. Go ahead.
So I think that, you know, I can't speak to much before, you know, January of 2020 when I got here. There is some historical information of what happened in 2011 and 12 that started, you know, the decline, all of which have been, since I've been here, been looked at and are being rectified. And there are some, when Mr. Dindale was out, we were kind of look at, you know, in Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City, we tend to often get these highs and lows throughout the day that can really skew the answer times and the ability to answer 911 calls, anywhere from 15 or 20 911 calls an hour to 60, 70 plus 911 calls an hour. And that becomes a challenge of how do you staff for that? We can pull those incidents out and look, was it a windstorm? Was it the earthquake? Was it a fire? Was it a plane crash and things like that? But that feeds into that. And I think one of the things we're looking forward to with the new next gen 911 phone system is allowing us in the region and the state is to balance that workload. Because right now, all of that information, all those calls simultaneously come into VEC, where under the new technology and the new system, we can better evaluate that. And if we're busy and Salt Lake City is not, or Weber or Central Utah, we can balance that load. And then with the common CAD system, quickly and efficiently share information, answer the 911 calls for each other, and process them in an efficient, quick manner. So, but I think that's something, and I don't know how to manage to that because we don't know when things are going to happen. But I think if you really break down, because I print them my time report every day, I share with Jake every month when I pull it to make sure we're pulling the same data, and we can really see from hour to hour what's going on in the day. Where our, for lack of a better word, our weaknesses are, where we've staffed up. We've created cover shifts in the middle of the day where we're putting on 18 to 20 plus call takers during the busiest hours of the day to help compensate that. But again, when we get those one-offs where you get more than our magic number is about 32 to 34 911 calls an hour, you get above that, it gets extremely difficult to manage those numbers, and we do the best we can, but we can usually isolate and identify those events. But that causes some of the crazy up and down or that roller coaster ride that you see in the graphs and things like that. And we really need to break that information down over a period of a month and see what has happened. Are we not staffed right at certain times of the day? Do we have a lot of sick outs? Do we have things like that? And,
no, thanks. My daughter actually worked as a dispatcher in Idaho, so we've talked quite a bit about dispatching and that, as we've, you know, talked about what her experience is and just kind of, so I've tried to get a perspective, and boy, it's a tough job. I mean, there's a lot of things she really liked about it and enjoyed, but there's some difficult things too. But so the other question I had, and I guess you kind of answered that with, you know, the previous question, but the on hold, you know, issue, you know, it's tough, you know, sitting here visioning, you know, someone with a real situation with a child or something, and they're on hold, you know.
Sure.
Do you foresee a solution for that other than just more staff? I don't know
I think it goes back to what I stated earlier. It's a combination of being staffed properly and leveraging the technology that's available. Mm-hmm. I am a firm believer, and I will say it again, that the new phone system, which we're finally looking to deploy the first or second week in July, finally, will be able to mitigate some of those things where they hit the queue. That means all our 911 call takers are on a call and the calls go to a queue. So your point, sir, is, you know, 30, you know, 10 seconds to somebody feels like an hour in an emergency, right? So we believe, again, staffing and leveraging the technology will mitigate a lot of that. We're reconfiguring the entire workflow of the VEC center. One of the challenges we have now with our current system is non-emergency and emergency calls get commingled together in the phone system. We're going to partition those out, and that all comes with this new technology. So we're aware of some of the causes. We believe we can leverage that technology to mitigate them and increase the efficiency of the center and prioritize the workflow to meet our core mission and the needs. And I'm confident that as we deploy that technology, it'll show very rapid results, to Speaker Wilson's point, where maybe in 6 months we're hitting that number and then we can sustain it.
Yeah, thanks. I hope that's the case. Look forward to that day.
Yes, me too.
Thank you. I think Representative Gibson has a question or comment online. Go ahead.
Thank you, President. Welcome to Utah. We're going to give you some money. We want it fixed in 6 months. And it can be tough. I appreciate that. I guess what you know, I have my training is in Lean Six Sigma and process improvement and things of that nature. I don't think I've ever met you personally. You can look at me online and just kind of guess that I don't run very many marathons. But when asked, hey man, can you go run a marathon? My first response is going to be, hell no. Can you run a mile? So maybe that 95% is that marathon that you're looking at. Can you give me an idea? When I look at that, I see ups and downs, up, and I don't see any continuity toward growth. I mean, if I would have said, you know, 6 months ago, you were around the 87, 86 pretty consistently, what's my next step? Can I realistically get to 90 percentile and then maybe go from 92? And what realistically in your mind do you think now granted 95 is the national average, and that's probably the gold standard where everyone who thinks they're going to call 911 in Salt Lake County, where we're going to be at. Can you give me an idea? What's a realistic in 6 months from now, we can say, if not 95%, what do you think realistically? And I know I'm putting you on the spot here, because if you don't hit it, you're going to feel like a failure, but let's just say 95% is that marathon. I can't run that 26 miles right now. What do you think that number might be? Is it 90? Because I saw a lot of low dips in the 80s at 92. What do you think?
I would concur, you know, again, provided we stay on track with the technology and we continue the hiring and the training, you know, I think we could land in that high 80s to 90 percentile on a consistent basis. And then what's that last bit of it to get us across that finish line? Because like you, I'm a Six Sigma guy and graduate myself, so I get it. We've broken this down multiple ways, and you know, if we were landing consistently in that 89 to 90, 91 percentile, I'd be in a lot better place, knowing that last four or five percent to hit that consistently is just a massaging of something we either missed or something that would be directly in our control.
So in driving out the noise, have you been able to find you have a consistent variable that seems to be a consistent theme in your processes?
Well, again, it's where, you know, two CAD systems, it's a legacy phone system, and people. It's those three things, and two of those things, the people resource, the people person, has been a work in progress, and we've been doing, I think, well in that area. The phone system and the CAD system, we've been working hard since I've been here. Matter of fact, soon after I got here, we had to get the CAD project reaffirmed with the UCA grants. To deliver that, and that'll be online by the end of this year, and the phone system in the next 45 days, I believe, is 45 to 60 days will be the new phone system, and I truly believe that phone system should get us at least 10 percentage points on a consistent basis to deliver the services, the CAD and the staffing and the training gets us the rest of the way. So I mean, I'm comfortable with that. And if we missed, you're right, I'll be disappointed, crushed, and a little confused on what more are we missing to the model works. It's just a matter of having all the right pieces in the right places.
All right. Well, I won't continue to beat a dead horse. I know you feel pretty, I'm sure you're not happy with what's going on and not happy with these results as well. And so to labor on would be a waste of both of our times, but just, I wish you luck. Continue to stick for that. And maybe 95 is where you ultimately want to be, but maybe have a realistic goal just to show those tiny progress and try to drive out the ups and downs, and more of a consistent trend line moving upward would maybe be my recommendation, but I'm just one person. So I appreciate what you're doing. And I feel for the struggles that you have ahead of you. So good luck to you.
And I appreciate it. I want to reiterate to the committee, I mean, more than we can expand the reach of that monthly progress performance report. I am extremely transparent. So if we're not delivering, you'll see that. If we are delivering, you'll see that with no fluff. I mean, numbers don't lie. It is what it is. But we're going to fix it.
Thank you. I was going to go to the speaker for a motion. Before I do, I forgot, does that conclude your presentation? I think it includes our questions, okay? So
I'm done.
Okay.
Gladly, yeah. He's done.
We have Elsie Haggerty, I think, here from Salt Lake City. We'd like to hear from you if you've got a minute. And again, we're running a little tight. In fact, we're about a half an hour over, but don't worry. Take what time you'd like, as long as it's just a few minutes.
Well, thank you for letting me come and represent Salt Lake City 911. We did lose our director this year. She retired. As you all know, 2020 was extremely difficult. The earthquake was very overwhelming. And yet we continued to, as you saw, stay over the 95%. We also had civil unrest, unlike any other city in Salt Lake County. Salt Lake City really struggled. We had a day that our dispatchers actually had to go into lockdown. So they locked down the building, the public safety building, because of the riots that were going on right outside of the building. So we had employees that were there for almost 24 hours straight because it wasn't safe for them to leave. So what we've run into is our turnover has doubled from last year. We started the year fully staffed. We are now 27 people short. But we're constantly hiring, and Scott's right. It's very easy to say we're going to continue to be above the 95. That's always going to be our goal. When the hurricane, it was just a year full of that will never happen in Utah. And then it happened. A police car got set on fire outside of the dispatch center. We had hurricane force winds, and I'm from Florida. That was not a concern I had moving back here to Utah. So we're going to continue to push for that 95%. That's our number one goal. Every day we come to work and we know that the one thing we must do is answer the 911 calls for our citizens. I really appreciate your guys' time. Do you have any questions for me?
And I'll open it up for questions, but I'm looking at the graph, and since the last little while, you've been well over the 95, probably 98, had a little dip, probably when the police car was turned over or a hurricane, but you've been between probably closer to 98 than 95. How have you done that? And that's the question I think we're all asking when sure. We see what hasn't been done in the VEC.
So in 2018, Lisa Burnett took over as director, executive director. She was the interim. I was promoted to operations manager, and we made some pretty significant changes in January of 2018. It's interesting that just happens to land where we moved up and continued to be above the standard. We have working supervisors now, so we have 10 additional staff members that are required to take phone calls and handle our channels. They need to know how to do every job in the center. It gives our people the confidence that when they get quality assurance from a supervisor, they know how to do the job. We also changed shifts, which helped our employees feel a little bit less stressed and overwhelmed at work. We have implemented some EAP programs, so our dispatchers are actually more likely, just a little bit, but they are more likely to suffer from PTSD in comparison to police officers and firefighters, because they take a call and then they have no idea what happens. So there have been studies. We are now bringing a therapist into the building on occasion, so they can go on duty to go and talk to someone about a lockdown, about the fear of not being able to go home. That shouldn't be a dispatcher's fear. We are not in the public putting our lives at risk, but now our people are starting to feel that pressure. The working supervisors was probably our biggest change. We also upped staffing, so we have more people answering calls during the busier times of the day.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions. Thank you for that effort. And I'm going to now turn to the speaker for final comments and a motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move we refer a six-month follow-up of 911 call answer times for Evac and Salt Lake City 911 to the Executive Offices and Criminal Justice Subcommittee as the lead committee. And I'm going to add to the motion that we check in with VEC for another six-month follow-up of their 911 answer times.
Okay, we have a motion before us. So we have discussion. See no discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Roll that motion passes. That concludes our business for the day. Do we have anything else? If not, I'll take a motion, Mr. Speaker.
Move we adjourn.
Move we adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Roll that motion passes. We are adjourned. Thank you.